Welcome to this week's Anime podcast. We have my phone bringing in the background, but other than that, we have another kind of episode in our kind of season of revolutionary kind of armed groups. This week, we're going to be discussing the Black Panther Party, otherwise known as Black Panther Party for Self-Defense, I think, as it was originally called. This week, it is myself, Alex. Hello. Also with me is James, because he's always here. Hello, James. How you doing?
Hello. How you getting on?
I ate some taco chips today, and I'm really feeling my asshole is going to regret that. But that's the story for my toilet and me, not for you. Though I used to call you my toilet, but that was a different time in our life. And also, Ben, a newcomer to the podcast. How you doing, Ben?
Not bad. Nice to meet you.
That's suitably dour response, so that's excellent. Couldn't be more Scottish. Yes, what we're going to do is be talking about the Black Panther Party. Now, we're going to get to that in a bit, but first, our listeners have demanded that we try and be social in some fashion, because apparently normal people can have some command over small talk and general socializing, which I know nothing about because I try to live a very remote life from everybody. Apart from my wife, of course, but she may want to get away from me. But that's a different story. Now, James, what did you think? Because we kind of touched upon it in our last episode, and we're recording both the last episode and this episode in early June. What did you think of fucking the guards beating the shit out of teenagers at South William Street?
Yeah, it's kind of to be expected. And the fact that the head of the guard is an RUC man, and it would be a fucking stretch to say that the guards are fine or were fine, but for various historical reasons that we'll probably touch upon during like the IRA episode, they were a little bit better at de-escalating and policing by consent. Now obviously that doesn't mean much, but since I've moved here, it's steadily got worse, and it was getting worse before then, if you've seen anything that happened with the water protests and stuff. So it just happens to be that they've turned it on people that were just standing around having pints rather than ethnic minorities like travelers or protesters, because they're fine to bat on them every chance that they get. But obviously leaving the fascists absolutely fine. No bother to them. They can go about their business. No issues. Did you see anything about that, Ben?
I did see a bit through Twitter. I didn't really get the whole gist of it, but I knew it was an ex-RUC guy that seemed to be in charge of things going to shit. So, yeah, that didn't really surprise me much. I don't really follow Irish politics that closely these days, but it seemed like a really shit thing going down.
When was the last time there was a kind of back in charge in Scotland, or in one of the main cities in Scotland, like Glasgow or Edinburgh?
That absolutely beats me. It must have been ages ago. Like the only ones I can think of were like during like minor strikes, maybe.
Yeah, because me and Alex did like a lot of protests in Edinburgh, and even though that they were spying on us and trying to infiltrate the anarchist groups that we're involved in, on the street in a protest situation, they tended to be fairly jovial, and, you know, there was the moments here and there, but you could pretty much just rip the piss out of them as much as you wanted all day long and wind them up and get away with it. And that would be different if you went to Faslane. They tended to take that a lot more seriously. I wonder if that's as much of the case now, especially, you know, when me and Alex were doing these protests. This was before the austerity had really kicked in. So I think, from what I understand, like policing's got even worse in terms of that, because, you know, people have left, and the people that are there are the ones that do it for the love of being a cop rather than doing it for the dosh.
Silence. I think that means Ben agrees with you. Or he forgot to turn his mic on. But anyway.
Yeah, but he's open in a small island. So
is he? So he just has to worry about the fucking Royal Navy showing up to get shoot crofters then, is he?
they burn a place every year where he's from, so.
So tell me, Ben, is there any plans for a sixth Jacobite rebellion, or is that just has that been put off for another year?
I'm trying to get the People's Republic of Man in the Isles to happen, but nobody's really taking me up on it. There's about 3,000 people in my island, so it's kind of tough going.
You got to bring back the Stuarts, man. That's the only way to do it. I mean, I know they're fucking not particularly Scottish, and at this point, I think they're from Liechtenstein. I think that's the closest kind of comparison. But it'll get the clans going, at least until they see the Marines or the Royal Navy rocking up in a gunboat. Then they'll go, I'll see you later. Run the opposite direction, like any smart person. Yeah, I know. For those who are listening to this from the States, by guards, I mean Garda Síochána, the Irish Police Service. They baton charged a group of mostly kind of teenagers, people in their early 20s, on a street in Dublin called South William Street in either late May or early June. I can't remember the exact date now. But other than that, Dublin is...
I mean, it was like 2 days ago, dude.
I can't keep track of when this is going to come out versus what date it is now versus whenever it happened. I can't keep track of all these dates. It's too many. What do you think I am, a historian? Anyway, but... What we might do is, for those who are listening, that's kind of the thing that's going on at the moment in Ireland. There's a lot more discussion about the fact that for the last 12 years, vulture funds and various international capital has bought up most of the fucking houses that have been built. And suddenly people were like, wait a second, is this actually been happening for 12 years? Even though people have been saying it from in the screechiest of manner for the last 12 years. So, yeah, I've met a lot of people who are like 20, 21, 22, who are very depressed suddenly. All of them saying they're going to leave the country, and many of them tweeting that they're going to leave the country. So we'll have to see what happens now. But I wouldn't blame them, since I left the country as well, moved to Edinburgh. And then after that, very ill-advised move to Canada, which James often mocks me about, and justifiably so. Let's just say I moved there to be with somebody who had a great what's the word? Center of gravity. James often says she had a great center of gravity. You couldn't push her over. Like five guys pushing her would not fall over. She also enjoyed eating mayonnaise out of the packet. But again, we should stop talking about my love life or my former love life. Let's instead talk a bit about Black Panthers because that's why you're actually here. The Panthers. In some fashion existed from about 1966 until the early 80s as a organization, though there are kind of neo-Panthers these days. There are actually, funnily enough, still about 20 Black Panthers in prison in America. Most of them are fairly old now, their 60s and 70s. And most of the original leadership are dead, whether it be Eldridge Cleaver, who was kind of the theoretician. He died in the late 90s. Whether it be Huey Newton, who was shot dead, probably in a drug-related incident in the late 80s. Whether it be people like Fred, I think his name is Hamilton, was it? James, was it Hamilton, do you remember?
There was a Hamilton, yeah, but I've forgotten his first name.
I think it was Fred Hamilton. He was murdered, of course, in I think, 69 or 70 by the FBI and the Chicago police. And most of the rest don't have a lot of very positive things to say about the Panthers after the initial period of their formation. There's a lot of kind of, as often there is with ex-revolutionaries and parties that kind of become cults, there's a mixed reception amongst the survivors for what they went through. But it was undoubtedly a very exciting time in their lives and certainly a revolutionary time, though. As this series of podcasts on revolutionary groups will kind of hopefully convey, not all revolutions are successful. Quite probably most of them aren't successful. And the Panthers, what they wanted to achieve, it'd probably be, you'd have to be unbelievably optimistic to believe they had much of a chance given the huge opposition they faced at the time. But we're going to be talking about that. Does anyone want to kind of go into a bit about the background to the Panthers? Why was it that young, and there are most Black Panthers at the time, the late 60s, were teenagers and in their early 20s. They were mostly young people of the baby boom generation who had grown up as African-Americans, kind of seeing the civil rights movement, but also experiencing police brutality, something which obviously is still something that African-Americans are dealing with now. But do you kind of, Ben, would you like to kind of go into a bit about the background to why the Panthers were, you know, something that emerged out of in America in the mid 60s?
Yeah, I think there's a whole bunch of things. I mean, the Panthers started in what, like 66? And that was after the bulk of the civil rights movement had really like gained momentum and got some concessions from the establishment, if I remember right. But there's two kind of inflection points in the late 60s, I think, that kind of led to the Panthers growing kind of explosively. Like the first of those is probably the Detroit uprising in 1967, which is like one of the biggest riots in American history, I think. And I think it just spun out from a bar that was getting raided or something like that. And like it escalated into an open confrontation with the police, and then the army got called in and all that kind of stuff. And the whole city burned for days, thousands of people injured, all that. And the second inflection point, I think, is obviously going to be the assassination of Martin Luther King, which came the following year. And I think that intensified the growth of the Panthers as a movement, and like of Black Power more generally. I think that I'll just leave it at that at the moment.
No, that's a good beginning. There's other stuff as well. I mean, there's just the ongoing problems, which are just day-to-day problems of being a young Black man in Oakland in California, and the police violence there. In a documentary, which listeners can find at the bottom of, in the kind of the description of the episode, there's one of the former Black Panthers was saying that even though the civil rights movement was based in the South of the United States, the police violence was everywhere. It was consistent across America, that the level of stop and search, the level of murder of young Black men, which is still something going on today, obviously. So the Panthers, in particular in Oakland, you know, which is becoming, I think, gentrified now in the modern day, but at the time was a ghetto in every sense of the word, you know, was how do we protect young Black men from the cops? And it kind of began in a very simple way, which is that they were just going to patrol the Oakland area and Black communities with armed, again, with legal firearms, and just watch from a safe distance, as in, a legally acceptable distance from the cops, to make sure they didn't shoot unarmed Black men. And that's kind of how the original Black Panthers started, as a defense organization for self-defense, which was the Panthers' full long title back in the day. And out of that, it's just kind of, it starts to gain momentum. I think the thing that probably kicked it off the most was there was an attempt by the California legislature to actually pass laws to limit the possession of firearms, or at least the carrying of firearms in public areas. And that was directed very publicly at the Panthers. And they showed up, about 30 of them showed up in Sacramento, armed, of course, and walked into the Congress, very much like the January 6th demonstrations in Washington, except there was 30, not several hundred. And lo and behold, even Ronald Reagan, who was the governor of California, was there at the time. And this was beamed across America, and suddenly the name Black Panther and the leaders, including Huey Newton, was there, and Bobby Seale, were now on being invited to talk. And that visual image of the kind of the black leather kind of jackets, the black kind of turtlenecks, the black berets, the full afros, the beards, the kind of confident kind of talk of for revolution, that suddenly was beamed everywhere. And it kind of seems like the early period of the Panthers was almost like an element, kind of a part of the culture, in terms of kind of counterculture, in terms of kind of, you know what I mean? Like it kind of fit into that idea, kind of rock and roll, you know, period. It wasn't merely just that they were saying, hey, let's have a revolution. It was kind of the visuals that they presented. James, you're a man who spends a lot of his time thinking about visuals and movies and art. What do you think the Panthers' visual propaganda, just in general, how they dressed, how they carried themselves, how that affected young Black people in America? Pardon me, in America.
Well, I mean, you do see it has like a huge impact on popular culture, even within stuff today. And it's a great way to propagandize, really, especially then where the amount of, you know, African Americans that you would see in film or TV would be minuscule. So to see something like that, especially at the time, you're getting a real growth in Black culture being able to move out in terms of cinema, where it's a bit cheaper to make films. It's such a striking look. I think it really is something that has to be taken forward. If you ever plan to do anything like it again, where it's the semiotics of it are basically like, you know, are like, one, it's, you know, like projection, hey, like we're the cool dudes, but also the cool dudes, oh my god, what dad thing. It's like the Black Panthers were the real cool dudes. But yeah, also it is that sense of threat that also comes with it, even without the guns, the bandoliers themselves. It's a really interesting and quite evocative format to go with. And so just to reiterate, I really think it is, if you're planning on creating a revolutionary movement, you have to do it with an eye on the aesthetic as well. And, you know, it usually happens by mistake. You know, they didn't do this on purpose. It sort of just grew organically when they kind of clicked onto it. But if you think about, say, something like the Cuban Revolution, they've got, you know, that aesthetic with the green shirts and the way that Che and Fidel grew. So, yeah, you're really onto something there in terms of what you should be thinking about.
Now, when many young African Americans see this on TV, there's this kind of huge organic growth Panthers across different parts of the United States. There's not really much planning in the early stages, it just grows. People ring in and say, can I find an office here, there, and everywhere? And they do. And people are drawn to it. Some of the survivors of the original Panther movement have said this was would turn out to be their biggest weakness, because they didn't really look into who these people were. And as we'll get into later in the podcast, but you can probably guess, groups like the FBI and police intelligence were amongst those who were joining even as early as that. But before we get there, Ben, now the Panthers have been described themselves as a vanguard. They weren't merely seeking, like people say, oh, they're Black nationalists. Well, they weren't really. If you look, the 10-point program that existed was pretty social democratic, pretty basic in terms of what it wanted: decent housing, education, and end police murder and brutality of African Americans. You know, in the sense that they were revolutionary, I suppose that they were a revolution in how they were facing off against the state and facing off against the police. But in actually what they wanted, it was fairly, you know, from our perspective, would seem fairly unrevolutionary to demand these things. How would you describe them ideologically speaking, if you could place them on a spectrum?
That's a tough one. I mean, yeah, I would definitely say they're a revolutionary party, even if their aims were quite modest in terms of, like, you know, what could be expected by white Americans at the time or such. But I think the red Fanon, the red Mao, and they had this self-perception as like a colonized people, as an internal colony in the United States. And so, like, even with these fairly modest demands, there was a sort of a freight of a kind of an insurgent nationalism, an ideology of national liberation, I would say. So, like, as much as they were a party and like a mutual aid organization and all the rest of it, I would say that they were possibly verging on an insurgency as well, and definitely very, you know, very militant.
James.
I think it's really weird to say that they're not revolutionary, considering that, you know, we just saw in the UK a couple of years ago, someone that is like, you know, and Jeremy Corbyn doesn't even have like one of their points on his whole, you know, it was all very tame compared to what they were asking for. And he was eaten alive by every conceivable force that could be mustered against them. If a party came out and with that 10-point program now, can you imagine the amount of shit that would be filled in Hack's pants right off the bat? You know, and especially considering their overt Marxist building blocks that they used to you know, build their ideology from. It was an inherently revolutionary, and it would still be revolutionary now. And I think they're a really good touchstone. I mean, yeah, it all goes tits up later on, but I think if you want to talk about, like, how do you get stuff done, how do you start with two or three people and end up with an organization that can shake the foundations of the American imperial project, you can't really do much better than point to anything other than the Black Panthers.
No, I agree. I was merely pointing out that, or rather ham-fistedly pointing out that if you actually look from our perspective today at the program, it seems quite tame, but that suggests more that the system itself at the time was so reactionary and so white supremacist that their demands were revolutionary by, you know, when facing off against that. But from us, from our perspective, it just seems somewhat tame. But I agree, you know, there's more to it than that. The thing that the Panthers are unfortunately most known for is kind of their what they did in front of the media and what the media covered them for, the shootouts, pardon me, and murders and blah, blah, blah. Well, and we'll get to that. But one of the things that doesn't get really talked about unless you read into bother to read about it or do some research is the amount of community-orientated organizing that they did. So whether it be kind of free school meals, whether it be sickle cell anemia checks, whether it be, you know, in general, medical clinics and communities. What does that say? And I do think it's actually the best thing in terms of what they did was they understood that not only do you have to have, okay, these ideas, not only do you have to have the visuals, the aesthetics that they had, the way they talked, the way they walked, but you need to have a ground game in the community you live in. It actually reminds me a bit of what we talked about last week, which was Hamas. And Hamas, maybe they learned from the Panthers because they made sure that the people who supported them and that they recruited in had a reason to support them. And that's something that the Labour Party, if you can call it left-wing, you know, hasn't figured out. And certainly most left-wing parties don't do that. And yet I think it's probably the most obvious thing to do to build support and to build a base within a community. James, what do you think about that?
So I think it's really, really important to stress how successful, say, like their meals, breakfast for kids program was, because going around and waving guns around near the police was going to save a couple of people's lives, and you fully understand why they're there and completely support it. But the FBI did barely give a shit right up until it turned out that this, you know, these social programs were effective, because then it had white people on, you know, white liberals interested. And that is what really frightened the FBI and the security forces of America. And that's effectively kind of what starts their downfall is, you know, how successful this program is when they start getting infiltrated and made enemy number one. And so that gives you an idea of like how successful it is in terms of just on its own volition, but also as propagandizing as well.
Yeah, I was just going to say about the breakfast program. It's really interesting because it sounds quite benign. It sounds like, you know, they just get a bunch of food and serve food to a bunch of children, but it relied largely on donations from like supportive local businesses and stuff like that, and that some less supportive businesses may have actually got kind of shaken down and all that kind of stuff. So it's already a kind of high risk endeavor. It's got a large footprint in terms of like all the businesses it's affecting and all that kind of stuff, and it's generating a bit of heat with the police already if there is armed intimidation of business people and all that kind of stuff. But also, like a lot of police harassment happened to the breakfast program as well. A lot of these breakfast kitchens were shut down or raided by the police, you know, under the auspice of checking for drugs or other criminality like that. And they would quite often just destroy wholesale all the food that they had gathered to feed the children with. So, I mean, well, it sounds quite benign. It's also quite a high-risk endeavour.
I mean, it's that sort of stuff still plays out now. If you see, I can't remember if it was this year or last year, but you know, the school meal stuff that's happening in the UK, where there's a footballer effectively, you know, doing more for school meals than the supposed Labour Party is, and how things have changed basically, because previously, you know, who you would expect to at least be tacitly on that side, the Liberals, like effectively most of them sided with Boris Johnson, who's, you know, like two steps away from complete fascism. And to be like, oh, well, actually, no, we can't really afford to feed kids. And then when it was implemented, it was done to line the pockets of Tory donors. So if, you know, if there had been a group that actually cobbled together and actually done the school meals themselves, you know, that could have been a bigger vote winner, or at least like headline grabber, than pretty much anything that the left has done for the last 10 years.
No, I agree. I think the Panthers understood where, who they were fighting for. I think there's probably an element, a large element, that the Labour Party is divorced from whatever it thinks its base is, and therefore doesn't particularly, or what its base should be, which is workers, and therefore don't particularly care if they're starving, or will say, oh, it's the Tories' fault, we don't have to do anything. And I know this because one of the former hosts, Dan, who lives in, a part of England, when he was, he told us, I think last season, that there was an attempt to start a kind of a charity, a local charity, kind of like a food bank, to try and support people who were on the breadline, you know? And the response from the Labour Party, the local Labour Party, was either this is run by commies, or this is patronizing, or this is whatever, or you need to do what we say, or we want to take, you know, support, you know, we want to do nothing but take all the goodwill. So I do think that that says more about the Panthers, that they were grounded in the communities that they were trying to improve, whereas Labour Party isn't. It's, you know, as exemplified by the fact they parachuted a guy into Hartlepool who had voted against Brexit and had consistently tried to get a second referendum, while Hartlepool had voted for 70% to have Brexit. So, I mean, again, divorced and detached from reality. The Panthers, as James said there, quite early on, they're having these types of successes, and many others, or too many to talk about in a podcast. But it's early on that the FBI, in particular J. Edgar Hoover, sees them as an enormous, probably the threat to the American empire, these domestic threat. The perception amongst most cops, again, some of them you can see interviewed in the documentary that I'm going to post underneath. They say, you know, these guys are terrorists. We view them as terrorists. And we basically said, well, we wanted to get rid of them by any means necessary. And out of this comes what's known colloquially as Co-Intel Pro. Now, without going into enormous detail, does either of you guys want to kind of go into how the state kind of infiltrated groups like the Panthers, and still do? I mean, when we were living in Edinburgh, there was a very popular case. I think the man's name was Mark Kennedy, and he was a police officer who had pretended to be a eco-activist and had actually had, I think he had a kid with one of his one of the activists he was lying to, and there was a court case about it. So infiltration by, you know, federal police services, by MI5, by MI6, this is not unusual, and it's certainly something that any revolutionary or person who wants to change society has to be very, very aware of. And I think the Panthers just weren't aware of it early enough. Ben?
I think that part of the Panthers' appeal was that they like projected a strong, kind of positive, assertive black masculinity. And this appealed to a lot of what I think is internally called in the party the boy on the corner, which is a kind of lumping proletarian kind of, you know, maybe young, jobless, or like, you know, low paid work, maybe a bit of a petty criminal. And I think this probably, as much as anything, gave law enforcement a good bit of leverage to create a network of informants in the Black Panther Party. And I think that's probably where the infiltration started, to be honest. Because, I mean, you can think of young people seeing, you know, these strong, assertive presences on the news, wanting to join the party because they love the whole aesthetic and all that kind of stuff, and it leaves them very open to exploitation by law enforcement.
Yeah, I mean, a couple of the people interviewed in the documentary below say that I had a criminal offence. The cops basically had me over a barrel, and my options were to go to prison for 30 years or to do business with them, and most of them did business.
Yeah, you also have to remember that just the police force itself were able to get their detectives in there. If you've seen the film Black Klansman, it's basically a complete liberal wank fantasy because the real cop that it was based on spent more time running interference on the Black Panthers than anything that they did with the KKK. It is kind of interesting, though, that they fell foul of this, considering that how well read they were as a party. And there's there is like formats that you can do to limit it. You know, do what the Bolsheviks did, which is like you have to have two people vouch for a member before you let them in, etc., etc. I do wonder if part of it was that they expanded at a rate that they hadn't really planned for. And within that itself, you know, as the problem with all left groups, and it's not unique to Marxists, there was power struggles within the group as well. And so they hadn't really planned for those scenarios, especially when your leaders like Huey Newton are going to prison for chunks of time or fleeing to Cuba and things like that, where you know, you've got these power vacuums in. So people are getting guys off the street on to join the party to be in their side to power it. It was kind of like the perfect storm to bring people in to run interference for.
Yeah, just to add on to what James was saying there, like the other kind of secondary effect of infiltrating a party like the Black Panthers is you create so much paranoia that it can then be exploited by your agents. Like I think there was this one guy, George Sams, who was an informant that infiltrated the Black Panther Party, and he was able to get away with rape, murder, and torture under the auspices of cleaning out people that he was saying were snitches. And all this time, he was probably working for the feds.
Yeah, I mean, Hoover was pretty obsessed with the danger from basically what he called a Black Messiah arising from the Black Panthers, that there would be a figurehead, a bit like Martin Luther King, but actually militant, or far more militant, like actually Malcolm X, really, a figure like Malcolm X. And so he saw that danger repeatedly. And so the informants don't merely just run interference or provide them a lot of information. There's active, basically planning to try and catch these guys, either quote unquote in possession of drugs or in possession of weapons. And so the leadership starts taking a lot of casualties, whether it be Huey Newton, who is arrested, I think when he's pulled over along with a friend of his in a car, and is arrested, I think, for possession of weapons. Eldridge Cleaver, who was a writer and member of the Panthers, he is surrounded in the house. Again, one of the people he's with is killed. He gets out and flees to Algeria. Fred Hamilton, I think is his name. I'm pardon for anyone listening who knows his real surname. I think it's Hamilton. He is organizing in Chicago, and he's assassinated by the police and the FBI. That's like admitted now. So they do a very good job of targeting the COINTELPRO and the feds and the police do a very, very good job of targeting the leadership of the Panthers in the late 60s.
I think it's worth pointing out that this was really where the American Central Intelligence Services really cut their teeth on learning how to do this stuff. They'd obviously done it into the past to some extent, but the complexity that they did it with, the sheer amount of psychological warfare that they were waging on basically everyone at the time. You know, there's actors that have the crime of effectively having an interest in left-wing academia or have met the Black Panthers, are basically being followed and bugged to the extent that they're having severe mental breakdowns. And when this stuff is talked about, you know, in documentaries and in the news articles, they all sort of seem to paint it as it's something that happened in the past, which is not true. It's just got even more sophisticated. And so it's just harder to see it because it's been such a background noise for the left for so long. It's still like every day, you know, the FBI, the CIA are the ones that are cranking out some of the most stupidest opinions that you'll see on social media. If you think that there's a group that honestly is a Black liberation group that are trying to cancel Karl Marx and Anne Frank, and you think that they're real, then there's a bridge that I'd like to sell you, because they're clearly just fucking the CIA up.
And that kind of leads to maybe the most important lesson to be learned from the Panthers, in terms of anyone who would want to form a revolutionary group or in some way follow in their footsteps, if you want to make the lives of African Americans better in a revolutionary manner, which is I suppose that being aware of police, of the feds, of CIA, because they're not they're not opposed to operating within the United States, even though they're not meant to. They do. If you're going to be trying to organize or trying to change things and not be aware of that, if you're going to have leaders who, for good and bad reasons, are going to be make mistakes. I mean, the problem was all these guys, Huey Newton, Eldred Cleaver, I think was older, but Huey Newton and what's his name, Seal, Barry Seal. Anyway, they were both very young. They were just, I think they dropped out of university to start the Panthers in 66. So they weren't old, and it's no reason to suppose that they would have thought that even the FBI were that duplicitous and that kind of Machiavellian. But now we know that they are. And in fact, as James said, they're only have got better at what they do. You'd be foolish not to automatically assume that they're there somewhere in your midst if you're starting a group. So, and it becomes doubly hard if that group is led in a kind of top-down manner. Again, this is me putting my beliefs on top of this, but I think that one of the problems with having those type of top-down movements, a kind of Marxist-Leninist group, is it's too easy to, for, you know, things to be turned around, for power struggles to develop, for, you know, people like Huey Newton, who kind of went mad in the 1970s and destroyed, or was part of the reasons why the Panthers destroyed itself in the end.
I think it's also worth pointing out one of their big strengths was intersectionality as well. The idea of them being painted as effectively like Black ethno-nationalists is very much, again, like a byproduct of the FBI a propaganda campaign. They were by no means perfect when it came to this stuff, but you know, like Huey Newton was the first Black leader to come out in favor of gay rights. They had at one point the membership was almost 50% female. Now it was difficult for them to apparently get higher up in the ranks, even though they were doing, half of the work. But they also understood that, you know, lots of white people in America were really suffering from the capitalist system as well. And there was people all around America. At the time, obviously, Vietnam, you know, the Black Panthers were the only group that I know of at that time that had international connections, where they could meet the Viet Cong and have conversations and talk about, you know, worldwide revolutionary tactics and have connections with Cuba and things like that, where Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, they didn't have that reach for various reasons that are very complicated, partly, you know, to do with their ideological standpoints and where they were coming from. And I think that's just like a real lesson to be learned, is they didn't do a great job of it, but they did have a start of the understanding that it's not purely a racial thing, it's a class thing.
Yeah, I just wanted to add on to what James was saying there. The Panthers were very good at building out a coalition with other groups around the country, particularly like on the radical edges of the anti-war movement. You know, people who are more likely to say, yeah, fuck the troops than bring the troops home. And I think that's, you know, again, that's probably one of their strongest aspects, was being able to forge links with groups like the Young Patriots, what you call them, the Young Lords, Peace and Freedom Party. I think the Peace and Freedom Party even ran Eldridge Cleaver as their presidential candidate. So they had all these links with other radical movements throughout the country, and were able to like build a strong kind of coalition with them on various shared interests. Like I think they would even joined up with the American Indian movement and stuff like that. It was really, you know, I think that's a really important lesson to learn from the Panthers, is that you need to be able to build these coalitions, and you need to also have groups to represent these interests involved.
I guess another lesson to be learned as well is one of their main death nails was trying to get involved in voting politics, when they basically closed all the chapters and tried to run someone for mayor. And yeah, they did all right. They got like 40% of the vote, I think it was. But, you know, they'd shut down all these chapters across America to focus on this, you know, like, gamble, and it didn't pay off. You know, and this was like in the latter part, but it just shows you that when it comes to parliamentary politics, when it comes to getting people to come out for vote for you, the deck is always really going to be stacked against you.
I mean, it should be said that there was other things going on before that. I mean, there was a main focus of the activism had become to get Huey Newton out of prison. I think he was arrested in 67, and I think it was 1970 or 72 or whatever it was, pardon to my listeners, watch the documentary below, you know the exact year. But he is eventually let out, which again isn't great either, because a lot of the focus then became, well, where do we put our focus next? And it wasn't an obvious step, because people like Newton wanted to focus on the kind of the food programs, the medical clinics, which was all really good, but again, what was the next step? And I think they kind of began to run out of steam when the mayoral race for Oakland came along, because it was once they lost that, as James said, the other chapters began to shut down, and that just the momentum was lost. I think when you're plotting these types of revolutionary changes, you kind of have to ride that wave of momentum, and either it crests and you achieve something, or it kind of collapses in on itself. And I think that's something that happens in particular with Marxist groups, because it's so personality focused. So there's a rather infamous TV event that happened in with the Panthers, where I think it was the kind of day-to-day, effectively the CEO, I suppose, I can't remember his name now. I'll post it in the notes anyway. And he had a phone conversation with Eldridge on national television, where Eldridge was saying, you know, you've expelled the Black Panther 21 who were on trial at the time from the party, Newton had. And your man came on and basically said, you're kicked out of the party too. Anyone like you is no longer wanted in the party. And all this dirty linen is exposed, kind of further undermining the cause. I mean, I think at the time there's Hoover and the FBI boys were saying, this is great, we don't even need to do anything anymore. These guys are ripping themselves apart. We can just stand back and watch. Job achieved. And I do think that, you know, it would be a disservice not to bring up that type of top-down organization has big problems when situations like this come, because they can't create new avenues for, or not very easily create new avenues for revolutionary kind of organization. It just, you fall back on whatever the couple of leaders who were in charge say. And it seems to me that's kind of what happened, that Newton kind of became, I mean, some of the things he did was pretty disgusting when he kind of became really hyper paranoid and started pistol whipping people. And there was accusations of sexual abuse and murder, and and that he was becoming more and more involved in the kind of black market and kind of crime. Do you think that that's something that kind of happens with revolutionary groups if they don't achieve, you know, some big achievement? You know what I mean? Like, if they don't achieve something big that you can put your hang your hat on, that they kind of disintegrate into something that can be quite toxic.
I think there's a bunch of things that happened towards the tail end of the Panthers, or at least throughout the 70s. I think one of the things that wasn't their fault and that they couldn't have had control over was that there was a process called Vietnamization, where US troops were pulled out of Vietnam, and the local forces took up the main brunt of fighting the Viet Cong. So popular dissatisfaction with the course of the war was tapering off. And so that left them with a diminished coalition that they could draw on, and like less lofty goals and all the rest of it. But also, yeah, the sustained campaign of you know, sabotage and internal strife brought down on them by the government, coupled with like internal paranoia that this created, and then the ensuing power struggles really fucked them up horribly. That and having like a diminished bench of like, you know, inspiring or charismatic leaders, like Eldridge Cleaver was in exile, Hampton had been killed, and Huey was like, I think he was addicted to heroin at that point, so everything was just a bit fucked up. I don't know if it's necessarily down to the character of the organization so much as just the context of the times.
No, but could you address my point there? I was saying, like, if you don't, like, again, it's like a wave. If you don't crest it a bit like a surfer and then kind of achieve something, that can kind of collapse in upon itself. Like, by if you're a revolutionary organization, the revolution doesn't happen, what do you become, you know? What do you think, Ben?
Yeah, well, I think you're probably quite right there. Yeah, the Panthers themselves are part of that. Them not meeting their goals, not getting their 10-point program implemented, and having kind of used up so much goodwill and energy on getting Newton out of jail, it does kind of seem that way, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I guess like their split as well, when the Black Liberation Army splits from the Black Panthers, that obviously causes problems, because then that moves more from an idea of self-defense, you know, using weapons to defend your community, to an offensive. And that sort of backfires in terms of the way that the media and the libs and people like that are thinking about the, you know, black radicals altogether. And also within the Black Panthers as well, is it was very much like it was in your entire life. Like, you, when you joined the Black Panthers, you didn't have a job on the site. You wore a Black Panther 24/7, which is great to get you started off and, you know, really build a movement. But it's not sustainable, because, you know, like, people are starting to get into the 30s, they're obviously going to maybe, you know, think about like, oh, maybe I'd like kids, or actually, you know, live in some sort of comfort rather than continuously, you know, living in this sort of, you know, semi-warlike state all the time. And so to some extent, it's not sustainable over any length of time. It's good in short bursts. And so if you don't have people moving away and coming in and sort of taking their positions like that, and those other people sitting in an advisory format, I guess, you're just going to burn everyone out pretty quickly. And that's clear by, you know, the late 70s, is that, you know, a lot of people's hearts aren't in it anymore.
And to that extent, I think the security apparatus of the American elite has proved itself very effective in kind of defanging, or at the very least playing rope-a-dope. Not that it was really the same, it wasn't like the Rumble in the Jungle, but, you know, waging out these groups. Because again, it's, if you don't have the type of analysis that says, okay, this is something that you're going to have to build for a long time. I mean, again, it's the folly of youth. I mean, a lot of the people who are interviewed about their time in the Black Panthers said the same thing, which is the greatest strength was their youth, their passion, their militancy. But they said that was also the greatest weakness they had, which was they were inexperienced. There were lots of things they didn't know. The passion, their passion sometimes overcame them. Certainly for people like Eldritch Cleaver, who could have been a bit more, a bit more kind of realistic in terms of what he thought was possible. In the early 70s, certainly, he was of the view that kind of having some type of guerrilla war was the way to go. But I think that would have been crushed so quickly if that had happened in the early 70s. I mean, if you guys think I'm wrong, you think that guerrilla war, you know, even with the Panthers at their greatest strength, I think maybe they had 5,000 members. Let's just say it's 5,000. With, you know, patchily armed with shotguns, pistols. I mean, they would have been flattened in an instant, wouldn't they?
Yeah, probably. But it would be... It's an interesting theory. And it's... Because it didn't happen, it's obviously... It's difficult to theorize on. I mean, there's possibly a scenario where all these disparate groups, you know, you've got your people in your reserves and people up in the Appalachians and your, you know, like revolutionaries that are still coming out of Mexico and, you know, South America. Obviously, you're getting up close to and around and during the... Oh my God, what's it called? The Contra, the Iran Contra affair and stuff like that. So that's always the thing. There's always probably, like, if everyone concentrated and really cobbled together, you probably could, you know, make a revolutionary army that would at least have some ability to gain some wins, if not for any length of time, but at least be able to stop the American apparatus at home for an extent of time. I guess it, you know, that would sort of tie into, if you were, you know, Easter Rising sort of theories, though.
Yeah, but I think, again, and it depends on what they want to do achieve. If they could have done something and then been crushed and been martyred, like the 1916 leaders were. Ben, what do you think?
I think there would have been the scope for some kind of, like, urban guerrilla insurgency. Like, they could have done some kind of nasty low-down gangster stuff to some cops or some politicians and made some waves that way. But I think the problem is that there is no end goal. There's no, even though they saw it as like a battle for national liberation, at least in the beginning when they had the internal colony analysis of like the status of Black Americans, there would be no possibility of like liberating any part of the country for Black people to live in, say, or anything like that. So they would have to have like demands beyond the 10-point program that they could have realized through this campaign, and they would need the support of the people as well, which by the time that this was being considered by Eldritch Cleaver had been pretty kind of hemorrhaged by their bad reputation. So I don't think that could have worked, to be honest.
I suppose the most important and perhaps the kind of last big question to ask is, if we're looking back on this from 2021, and we say, what is the... Because we've talked about some of the things to be avoided. I think we pretty much covered the things to be avoided. But, you know, trying to keep upbeat about kind of revolutionary groups or these types of militant groups, what's the best thing, having read about the Panthers and researched them a bit, what do you think is most that they had that the left is now most lacking and that we should try and replicate, because we know the mistakes, you know, we don't need to go too much more into them. But what do you think, if the left could learn from that and repeat or copy that in some fashion, we'd be in a much better situation today. And maybe James will say it from an Irish perspective and Ben could say it from a UK perspective.
I think the answers for both, though, is it's your fucking blueprint. It's your baseline level of getting stuff done, and it's kind of like a lot harder now than it was then, I imagine. Oh, I don't imagine what I'm saying, because, you know, they were three, you know, kids that were able to leave university and cobble together and get a shop front going. If three of us did that, like, we wouldn't even be able to afford rent for a house to live in, let alone, you know, cobble our money together to try and get a shop front off the go. So in many ways, like, we face scenarios that are much, much harder than what they had to do. you know, surveillance on the internet, but also just the police surveillance in all countries is so much more sophisticated and a lot more effective. You know, and again, there is ways around it, but it's a hell of a task. One, you pick up where the Black Panthers went wrong, and obviously in the, you know, the UK and Ireland, our access to weapons are fucking a lot more limited. But, you know, like in Ireland, we've already seen the Garda kill a defenseless black man last year. We're seeing them causing, you know, like going in and battering the shit out of teens in South William Street, as we were talking about. That scenario of us standing around and threatening them doesn't really work for us for a myriad of reasons, mostly because cops are very good at bashing people's heads in, and we're kind of all getting old and fat now. But their ability to call in squads, it would be very, very quickly. You need like 30, 40 people to sort of defend yourself. That would be a task. But I think something like that, someone will probably figure it out at some point of how to get that done. I guess we've got cameras now, which are obviously much more effective. You can stick a grill probe on your chest and I guess like wander around the city centre looking for guards or the cops that are harassing people and film that. But you know, you probably find yourself in a jail cell pretty quickly, so you'd have to accept that scenario. But in terms of organizing, getting stuff done, like just pull together and actually, instead of just like flitting about on Twitter and complaining about Labour or having a gripe that nothing's getting done, like you actually have to do it yourself. You have to, you know, get involved with other people. And I know it's difficult at the moment because of COVID, but it is about getting boots on the ground and getting people out there. And I do not think that our methods are effective anymore. You know, trying to picket an Aldi on a Saturday afternoon doesn't really do much. It's background noise now. You got to shake up the tree. You got to do something that's new. And, you know, I don't have those answers, but I know that they're needed.
Ben, what do you think from living in the remote parts of the west coast of Scotland, but living in the UK anyway, what do you think Scots activists or British activists can learn from what the Panthers did? The good, you know, the positive things, what could they copy?
I think like the main strength of the Black Panthers, especially early on, was like their appeal to the people, that they you know, the people in their communities. The things like the breakfast program and like the, you know, just presenting a bold and dignified presence that stands up to the powers that are oppressing people is probably something that really helped them early on. I can only really talk about it abstractly because I don't know if there's much that's really transferable to like the broad UK situation, but just in general, being embedded in the community and being able to rely on that goodwill that could give you food donations to set up a breakfast program, say, or anything comparable, like the ambulances or the blood clinics that they ran. You need to be offering people something, like a way out. You need to actually give them the chance of a dignified life to usher them into your organisation in the first place so that they can actually believe in what they're doing and actually help build it further.
Yeah, that's definitely what I would say, but basically the same thing. I think their cultural outreach or societal outreach is the one thing that I just don't see the left doing. The left, certainly of people our generation, in the millennial generation, people now in their, I think even the youngest, no wait, no, the youngest millennials are still in their late 20s. But anyway, the point is, there's just not really the same street game. And I know what James said is right. It's impossible now to get fucking a shop front. But there are other things you can do, whether that be kind of, get, you know, starting a charity or involving yourselves in if you're in Britain, in food banks. I mean, I don't know if there's many activists I can think of who are actively part of that. I know some try and they get a blowback from certain people, you know, libs, you know. But you know
what it is as well, though, is like having a plan, because you know these things are going to happen. So let's take a scenario that you're saying there, Alex, where you're saying like, let's maybe do entryism into a food bank. I don't know if that's been tried or not, but it's definitely piqued my interest in that idea. So you get, you know, 5, 10, 15 of you that decide, right, we're going to do something with this food bank, either set one up, I don't think that's really possible, or we're going to all volunteer at this and we're going to, you know, pull the mechanisms that are all of that food bank to actually get something done, to give the people that are going to the food bank some dignity. We're going to, you know, put our time in, our own hands in our pocket to actually, you know, bulk out the food, make it more livable on. And then you will quickly find that things go wrong in a number of ways. One, your own internal issues. Now, you know, me and Alex have been involved in many anarchist groups in the UK and Ireland, and it's unavoidable. It's just happened. And there's nothing wrong with it. It's just the way that people are. You have to plan for that. You have to plan for the fact that if you start getting successful, you're going to get flack from the right. You're going to have to, you know, understand that you'll probably have to defend yourself in one way or another from fascists. You'll have to learn that you're going to have to defend yourself from the Tory MP, the Labour MP, the Lib Dem MP, the right-wing press will come for you. Every dirty trick in the game will pull out for the least amount of work that you do there. And people have to go in with that mindset. And that is the big fucking problem with the left all around the world now, is they just think that they can do it on easy mode like everyone else does. And so we saw it with whatever they decided that thing was called in America last year, Chaz or whatever. And like, it was a good start. And so many of us pointed out, like, this is what you need to do. Here's where your plan is. Get the reading done. Like, you know, these are the faults. This is where it's gone wrong every time before. And they didn't listen. They didn't pay attention. And they just plowed on with what they thought was right. And yeah, they gave it a go, so good for them. But it fucking failed for the reasons that we set out, saying, like, you know, these are the things that happen. You just have to plan for it. It's that simple.
It was particularly annoying since I was involved in the Occupy in Edinburgh. And I was just like, wait a second, we did this 10 years ago and it didn't work. So yeah, there was an element of, oh God, here's that thing happening again. I suppose what we might do to finish up is, if you guys have any last thoughts on the Panthers or in general about what is the purpose, but your own opinions on groups like the Panthers, you know, kind of broadly speaking, Marxist, Leninist, but, you know, socialist kind of groups that, you know, mostly are living in quote-unquote Western countries, you know, because the Panthers were not obviously like the Bader Meinhof group or the Red Brigades that we'll talk about eventually, but is it better in countries like in America or in Britain, again, with caveats, is it better to use tactics that don't involve weapons or don't involve kind of the level of militancy that the Panthers brought? Is that something that's more sustainable in the long run than what they did, or do you think it doesn't really matter anyway, because obviously Martin Luther King was assassinated because the FBI decided to cut his protection because he was starting to go after class warfare and they wanted rid of him. So does it not make a difference either way?
I think the Panthers are kind of unique almost because they emerged pretty much solely from the black community in America, which puts them in a very different situation as far as violence is concerned from white activists. I mean, white activists might get their head beaten by the police, but as long as they don't threaten power too much, they probably won't get, you know, taken the fuck out. But because black lives are disposable in the United States to this day, violence becomes a necessary tool of whatever you're trying to achieve politically, even if only just for self-defense. So, I would say, you know, in a UK situation, an organization similar to the Panthers wouldn't have to necessarily arm itself. It would have to have good OPSEC and all that kind of stuff and be prepared to deal with fascists and be prepared to take a beating or have a bail fund for the police. But it wouldn't have to be as militarized as well as militant as the Panthers were. Beyond that, I can't really say much about other Marxist-Leninist groups. I'll leave that for your other episodes.
James, what about you? Last word. Do you think in countries like America or Britain, or obviously you can say whether there's a difference, that whether it's ideal to have militarized groups? I say this as an Irish person who knows a fair amount about the fact that the IRA had major problems organizing, though still managed it somewhat, but had major problems organizing in Britain throughout the 20th century because of its tactics. And certainly after the 50s and 60s, when bombings became more common, though they were common in the 40s too, it became a lot more difficult to organize. But what do you think, James?
I mean, yeah, one of the things that we're going to see so often in this season is you're damned if you do, damned if you don't. If you defend yourself, you'll be painted as a terrorist, even though full force is being used against you. So, you know, what happens is you turn around and you just become the thing that they're saying they are, because you're like, fuck it. I'm being treated as a terrorist. I might as well become one. And that's what happened to the Black Panthers. So it has to be done on a situation-to-situation basis, I think. What is the time like? What are you calling for? And I think if you were an armed group in the UK now, you wouldn't last very long. And that's partly just because how strict gun laws are in the UK, for better or for worse. But who knows, 10, 15 years down the line, when things are getting really spicy, I mean, we've seen that, you know, the UK government wouldn't even do the bare minimum to look after its citizens, you know, with COVID. So what's going to be happening when half of England is underwater and they're not doing anything? People are going to start taking things into their own hands, and you're going to have to start thinking about, how are you going to protect your community, if indeed, or against your community, depending where you live or how things play out? So it's a case of never say never. And it's always something to, you know, to keep in the back of your mind, because, you know, what's probably not happening enough at the moment is making the fascists scared. And that's because, you know, we're meeting them out in the street in groups and things like that. But long gone are the days where, you know, you start running an operation and wait for them when there's one or two of them outside of a pub on a Tuesday night and battering the shit out of them. And that's the sort of stuff that we need to go back to if you want to really strike fear into them, because that's probably a lot easier to get away with than a lot of people imagine. And that would be a way to bring that military, that, you know, tactics in to a UK setting, and really worry an enemy that only uses violence as its main tactic, you know?
Yeah, definitely. All right, we'll probably wrap up the episode on that note. For those who are listening, if you're listening on Spotify, if you can, I think you can subscribe on that, but certainly if you're on Facebook or Twitter, if you can share and subscribe, whatever platform you're on, that would be great. It certainly helps the algorithm, well, we're probably fucked with the algorithm anyway. I he says, as a person who barely understands what an algorithm is, it's something that grows on the back of your shin, right? Anyway, this week it has been myself, Alex, the lovely James, you going to say goodbye?
For legal reasons, I should probably point out that I'm not encouraging you to go out and beat fascists in pubs when you've seen them at marches. A wink.
Wait a second, that wink was rather suspicious. That was probably nothing. And Ben, it was lovely talking to you. Hopefully you are not accosted by the Royal Navy and the Crofters nearby to where you live are not going to be shot. So fingers crossed on that. But do you want to say goodbye to the folks?
Sure thing. Goodbye, folks. And don't worry about the Royal Navy. We burn a giant wicker man on the shore to scare them off every year, so it's okay.
Masturbate furiously as they sail away. Or maybe that's just me when I see the Royal Navy. But that's going to be us for this week, guys. Next week, James, what are we going to be doing next week? What episode or what revolutionary organization is next?
Tamil Tigers are next week. with our good friend Nikita.
Khrushchev?
No. I can't remember her last name, but her at is Jeremy Horbin, which is it always gives me a good laugh.
That's excellent. And whatever you do, always follow Misa Horny, the lovely Jar Jar Binks, who's obsessed with sex on Twitter, because it's fucking great stuff. Who doesn't love a horny Jar Jar? But that's going to be us, guys. We'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
See you, folks.